If we could figure out how to take this type of experience and produce it at scale, a massive amount more intelligence and resource we put into solving all the problems of the world.
Unconventional Life, the show where I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creators, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Twice a week, we will explore how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck. I'm your host, Joel Schroeder. Unconventional Life, welcome. This is your host, Joel Schroeder, tuning in today from Boulder, Colorado. Today's guest is joining us from California. We've got James Schmachtenberger in the house. James, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
I am, and I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. So super excited to have James on the show. We actually met several years ago at the Success Summit conference, and I know we've had a few of the Success Summit and the We Rise Up movie team on the show as well. And for those that don't know James, he is the CEO and co-founder of Neuro Collective, which is on a mission to really build a global movement that is capable of upgrading human capacity in the next 5 years. And on a personal level, I mean, your backstory, dropping out of school in seventh grade into starting all different kinds of initiatives, moving into cannabis, and then also moving into research and really being at the forefront of how do we improve the quality of life and what kind of systems, you know, are in place. And you've worked with, you know, systems theory and many different things. But excited to have you on the show because I think, you know, the quality of life conversation, and especially as we move into this, you know, new global relevance, I might call it unconventional world, at least at this point of the game, you know, it is really about doing things differently. So with that, James, welcome to the show. Fill in any gaps that I might have left out and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
Well, thank you for the intro. It sounded very good. It's always fun to hear people introduce me, because, you know, being in the thick of it for all the years, I don't really feel like I've done that much, but then I get the way that other people view it. And it's, yeah, it's always interesting. But yeah, to what you're saying, you know, most of my focus and work over the years has been around improving quality of life, both at an individual level and to the extent possible at a global level. And that's something that I've tried to approach from all types of different angles, from, you know, natural medicine to research and development to changing legislation and, you know, all kinds of things. But I think one of the things that just always stood out for me over the years is that what people put so much of their time and energy and attention into doesn't actually feel worth putting time and energy into. People seem to put a lot of energy into trying to win at a game that doesn't seem worth winning. How do I, you know, make more money just for the sake of it? Or how do I have status to show that I'm, you know, better than the next person? Or, you know, things that just don't actually feel like they actually are useful. And instead wanting to look at how do we help people redirect that focus and sort of change their underlying desires and goals to not just be about winning at the current game, but at actually designing a life that allows them to thrive, but also allows them to contribute in meaningful ways and have a deeper sense of purpose.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of always been my driver, was how do we increase the amount of people who are getting to live a life that feels deeply purposeful, where it's not just about personal gain, but it's also about the capacity to contribute at scale. And always wanting to explore ways to do that more and more fully.
Yeah. And, you know, it's such a relevant conversation. And I know, you know, back in 2014, potentially even before then, you know, is when you really got more focused on this inquiry. And I think a lot of our listeners can really relate to this. It is, you know, you're taking all of these, you know, attention and actions and energy, money, resources to a game, like you said, that, you know, isn't necessarily, I view it as even relevant to where we are today. It's like a historical blueprint. You know, I remember when I was graduating, you know, university and things like that, it was like, you know, maybe a few ways to make money. And now, you know, here we are almost 2020 and it's infinite of the possibilities. And what do you feel many people are missing in terms of like where time and energy and resources are allocated versus actually distinguishing like what's relevant and what really is important in terms of satisfaction and fulfillment and those pieces?
Mm-hmm. I guess a big part is I feel like people are far too willing to trade their happiness as well as their ethics for stuff. We have a society that largely values stuff, right? The more money you have, the more, you know, the bigger your TV is, the nicer your car is. Like these are things that are supposed to be what determine our sort of value as a person or our value to how we show up in society. And I don't actually find those things to be particularly interesting or valuable, but we're so often willing to give up the things that actually bring us real joy or make choices in business that we know aren't really right and maybe are not the best environmental choices or cause people to not be treated as well, but we're willing to do that to try to get ahead. And so I think a lot of the shift that needs to come is in terms of what it is that people prioritize and being able and willing to prioritize that which really lights us up and causes us to thrive and come into life and causes us to be on purpose, and then figure out from that, how do we make it work? You know, how do we get income? How do we turn that into a business if it's not already? But not to start from the lens of how do we make money and then be happy, which is sort of the standard narrative, right? But instead look at what is it that's going to actually produce real joy, real purpose, and then how do we convert that into something that can sustain us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like doing it in reverse order in a lot of ways. And, you know, I often, you know, again, hear from a lot of our listeners, it's like, okay, I kind of know, like, yeah, James, I totally agree with you. Like, yeah, the stuff is important to me. Yeah, I know the things that bring me joy, but I have all of this fear. Like, it's like this thing over here is very predictable. It's, you know, I can see it, I can touch it. It's a sure thing. And moving into this other world, I mean, there's so many unknowns. And so it's like, I'm scared, or how do I even, you know, I know it, but how do I start to live it? And any advice or perspective you could give on, you know, the transition of being in the knowing versus, you know, actually syncing up the action or really living it in reality?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. And, you know, these aren't necessarily things that will work for everyone, because obviously people have different styles and different personalities, but they're things that have worked well for me. One of them is that, I guess I learned a lot of years ago to stop putting a lot of attention on myself. I think that most people, when they're trying to start a business or grow a business or, you know, essentially anything, are really looking at it through the lens of what are their own personal needs and how do they get those needs met. And if that's what your focus is, that's sort of the extent of where the thinking goes. But that's not a very big lens to look through. And so what I started to look at a lot was, how do I contribute to society in the most profound way that I uniquely can, knowing what my skill sets, my passions, my capacities are? What is it that's uniquely mine to do, and how can I do that in a significant fashion? And then within that, how do I make sure that my needs are met? But starting off by the level of focusing on something bigger than ourselves, focusing on something that actually creates a real sense of passion, because it is exciting, and if we're able to succeed at it, it actually can move the needle. And then just making sure to architect into that system the ability for your own personal needs to get met. But one of the things that I've kind of realized over the years is I don't tend to have to put a lot of attention on making sure that my own needs are met. Because my focus is on bigger projects and is largely focused on how do I contribute the most value, it, for one, it tends to attract a really great group of people to want to work with me, because the vision of what we're working on is exciting. And as a result of bringing great people, great resources, we're able to be increasingly more successful in those bigger projects, and then having income and meeting my needs within that becomes quite easy. but where I feel like a lot of people spend a huge portion of their time trying to make sure that their own needs are met, that actually takes up a very small percentage of my time and attention. And it naturally happens because what is being focused on easily encompasses that need.
Yeah. Such good advice. And really, I think, you know, shifting into the collective perspective, or, you know, more from the I to the we, as I like to relate to it as.
Right.
It does take care of it in the proxy. And, you know, I said in the introduction, you know, dropping out in seventh grade, and I like reading your bio, so like, take that, Zuckerberg. But in so many ways, you know, you, and then you tried to go back, you know, your parents hired you a tutor to finish high school, and then you ended up at the, you know, Body Mind College in San Diego. And then you actually ended up buying the college and running that for 10 years. And then, you know, so many other different things. But I imagine the you that we're talking to now, maybe was or maybe wasn't, you know, say the you, you know, so many years ago. And so if we were to be a fly on the wall and we were to see glimpses of, you know, your evolution over time, like, what would we have seen? Were you like the awkward guy in high school? Were you into, you know, the arts and music? Was it all of the above? Were you athletic? Like, what would have been some of the pieces and even, you know, snapshots along the way that have really, you know, shaped you into who you've become today?
Good question. Yeah, I probably filled most of those roles over the years. I was, there was quite a while where I was really into athletics, and that was a big part of my life. And, you know, definitely helped build some of the drive that has kind of continued in different channels. Most of my life, I was very, very awkward, and spent years doing pretty intensive personal development work, trying to not only be happier, but actually just learn how to interface with the world in a way that wasn't so profoundly awkward.
Yep. Still working on that.
You know, there's a lot of great things that come from homeschool, but being good in social interactions is usually not one of those. And I wasn't homeschooled throughout my whole life, but I definitely was off and on a good bit. And so as I got to be sort of an adult, I had to actually teach myself how to interact and socialize with people. But no, I think what has probably shifted for me the most over the years in terms of business, but also just life in general, is that when I first started working on a lot of these projects, I had the passion that I do now. A lot of like the burning excitement and desire to contribute was there, but I was always trying to do it in a way that I thought it was supposed to be done, as opposed to looking at how would I do it. So, you know, whenever I was taking on a new business project or new venture, like, I would start to look at who were the most successful people in that field, and I would try to emulate them. Mm-hmm. I would try to study, you know, best business practices, and I would try to emulate them. And though there can be a lot that's really beautiful in that, in my particular case, what was happening largely was that I couldn't make sense of or figure out what it meant to sort of be uniquely myself in business, in philanthropy, and et cetera. And so I was trying to do it the way that everyone else would do it. And I was always looking to whoever was the best and trying to emulate that. And I think that for years that made a lot of the work less fulfilling and more difficult, because I was not really being myself while trying to do everything. Mm-hmm. And that's probably been one of the bigger lessons over the years, that has not only caused me to be able to enjoy what I do a lot more, but actually get much, much better at it.
Yeah.
Not trying to be like anybody else, not trying to use best practices, but really trying to look at how do I, given my unique set of skills and understandings and talents and weaknesses and all of that, like, how do I do this thing that matters? Not, you know, how would Steve Jobs do it or how would Elon Musk do it, but what is my style? And then starting to really learn to tune into that more and more. And then to surround myself with people who have the skill sets and the desires and the passions that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I really try to dial in the ability to show up and do things as myself, and then surrounded by great people who have the skill sets that I don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think in so many ways, it's probably more energizing. You know, I know for myself, the times where I've really been more in like the emulation space, you know, of how do I, like, I look at these greats, and, you know, even for those of you that listen to the show, and I've been guilty too at times where it's like, I just follow exactly what they're doing, then, you know, I'll get to the thing. But it also can be very exhausting. And I find, and I don't know if this is true for you too, when I am in my own blueprint, as I call it, you know, it's a lot more effortless in a lot of ways. It's just more natural or more instinctive in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm curious, like, what role does intuition, if you relate to that word, what role does that play for you in your decision-making and the choices that you make in both life and business? And how has your relationship to that, you know, shifted over time?
I would say intuition plays a massive role in my decision-making. As in, my goal is that it is the sort of primary way in which I do decision-making. And then I further inform those decisions with logic and details. But the bulk of the decision-making, I usually want to have come from intuition. And I wouldn't say that that's necessarily how it should be for everyone, because I think that people process differently. And like, I have a number of people that I work with who are very data-driven people. And for them, making decisions is really about collecting all the facts, analyzing it, and then coming out with what the answer is.
Yeah.
That's not how my brain works. And so for me, the sort of intuitive process of being able to take in huge amounts of information from different sources and then have the brain kind of synthesize and put that information together, even if you're not entirely logically clear on how that happens. You know, we have such a remarkable brain and nervous system, and the amount of information that it can process and make sense of, even outside of the scope of what we can be conscientious of, is just stunning. And it's something that over the years I've worked on trying to tune in and sort of rely on more and more heavily.
Yeah.
And I've actually noticed, you know, now that, I would say over the last few years, most of the time I actually do tend to trust my intuition in decision making. And every once in a while I won't. And like, I've had a few instances in different companies where I hired somebody and intuitively I knew it wasn't the right fit, but they just looked so great on paper and overrode my intuition. And then those ended up being the only people that don't actually work out long-term, and other people who maybe don't look nearly as good on paper or don't have as many years of experience, but intuitively have the right feel for the role, end up being awesome and, you know, sticking with me for years and doing great things.
Yeah.
But I, over time, I got the opportunity to kind of notice a lot of specific instances where when I would go against intuition and decision-making, it would almost always go south. And trust it, even if I couldn't logically explain why I was making that decision, it tended to be the right path.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I imagine the more you flexed it, I kind of view it like a muscle to some degree, and you get those confirmations, the more evidence or the more proof that it's like, hey, yeah, keep going with this. There is some validity here, you know, into that. And it's definitely a primary driver of my decision making. But a lot of, you know, our listeners, especially when moving from more of a logical or even conventional, you know, mindset, a way of thinking and creating, you know, it's like intuition isn't tangible. You can't point to it like you can, you know, data on an Excel sheet, for example. And so right. Any perspective or advice you could offer for those listening to this that, you know, they just so that they can keep flexing that muscle in a way that helps them be consistent with it that you've seen along the journey. Because so many of us, you know, I see somebody write in and it's like, Jules, I've got this muscle, but how do I trust it, especially when it comes to these big decisions? Yet I do think intuition can also be a access point into alignment in many ways as well. So yeah, absolutely. Curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting area because I feel like it's very easy to confuse intuition with, I'm not sure what the right way to say this is, but essentially having your own patterns or issues interrupt the way that you view reality. Because those will also affect your gut, right? So if you happen to have a particular set of traumas that you haven't healed, and you're viewing the world through that lens, anything that looks too similar to whatever your traumatic experience with may trigger something and give you a sort of gut feeling that says, don't do this, right? And that gut feeling feels like intuition, but it may actually have nothing to do with intuition, and it may just be that you got triggered and it's hard to delineate those. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of dialing in intuition and being able to get that skill increasingly developed and being able to trust it, a lot of the work is around self-awareness and discernment and being able to tune in that when we have those sort of gut reactions or those, you know, feelings or senses that we should or shouldn't go a particular direction, to then tune in and see, where is that coming from? Does it feel like it's really clean and really pure, or does it feel like I'm triggered? And that is a good piece to question. When, you know, and depending on someone's degree of self-awareness, and also depending on just the state they're in the moment, sometimes they can do that on their own, but sometimes it can also be really helpful to essentially test your intuition against other people that you trust and be able to run the ideas and the scenarios by somebody and say, you know, and here's what my gut feel is. Does that make sense to you? Or do you think there's something I'm missing? And get an opportunity to have a feedback loop. That I think can be really useful. And then also just looking at the specific facts around whatever the thing is and seeing, you know, if your intuition says go left and you look at all of the data, does the data also support the idea that you're supposed to go left, or does the data really clearly point the other direction? Mm-hmm. So you probably really need to check in and see, is your intuition actually tuned in or is it off?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some good tidbits there to play with as well. And I'm curious how it relates to, you know, even like your company, you know, the Neurohacker Collective, and even the concept of neurohacking in general. And I think that terminology has been thrown around. I'd love for you to define it for us as well, like what, you know, neurohacking or even, you know, neurohacker like means to you. But I think in part of it, it's not, you know, a carbon copy, right, that intuition relates to it. But I do think it's, you know, parts of the whole, which is also a concept of yours, you know, with the systems theory, that all parts, you know, add up to a larger whole to some degree. So I'd love if you could kind of define that and share a little bit about that and where the, you know, inspiration for that came from, and, you know, if you feel it relates at all to this thread that we've been on.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I mean, neurohacking is essentially the intentional use of various types of technologies to enhance one or more part of how we experience life, right? So the technology could be something in the realm of chemistry, right? Like, so some of the products that we make at Neurohack and people take, or it could be a transcranial stimulation device, or it could even just be having really good sleep hygiene, right? But intentionally changing certain inputs to, with the specific goal of improving how something works, brain function, creativity, processing speed, happiness, etc. So that's kind of what the field encompasses. What got me into it, and where I think that this field is a pretty extraordinary one, is that we do have the capacity to change our quality of life and to change our subjective experience of ourselves, of the world, of how we perceive the world, how we feel perceived by it, etc. And to do this through changing our behaviors and our inputs. And, you know, everyone is doing this all the time. It's just most of the time people are doing it by default, right? We come home from work, we're exhausted, we flip on the television, and that happens to be the inputs that we're being exposed to. And so now we're just, you know, we're as happy as we can be while having the majority of our time be tuning out. But we can change the degree of happiness or joy we have by changing what we do with our time. And rather than watching TV, we can spend it meditating or dropping in with someone that we love deeply or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting space. The thing that actually inspired me around it was that when I first started running Body Mind College, I was 18 when I took over running that company, and it was far too big of an undertaking
for an 18-year-old. Yeah. Given your relationship to education too, definitely an interesting choice, but I'm sure fitting.
Yeah. There was a lot that was ironic about that set of circumstances, but, you know, I was so committed to the work because I saw how much people's lives were changing as they were going through the deep sort of transformational courses that we would teach there. And so there was no part of me that was ever willing to let it fail. And I had no idea how to make it succeed. And so I would just make up for my lack of skill and understanding by working harder. And I did that until I just completely burned myself out. And I spent the first like 2.5 years running that company where I basically didn't sleep. And every time I would sleep, I would wake up in a sort of cold panic sweat at the magnitude of what I was supposed to be responsible for. And so by the time I was in my early 20s, I was totally burned out. I got diagnosed with stage 3 adrenal exhaustion. My brain was barely working. My working memory was shot, and just like all around struggling quite a bit. Which then of course drove existential crisis, because here I am running an organization that's teaching people how to be happy and I'm miserable.
The irony again.
Organization. So that, you know, there was a nice sort of clusterfuck that happened there. And it was in that process of trying to figure out how to heal myself and how to come out of burnout that a lot of the idea for Neurohacker came to be. I ended up, I experimented with quite a number of things that didn't do much for me. And then I got introduced to a doctor in Mexico who had developed the specialized IV treatment for rapidly repairing neurotransmitter damage, actually for drug addicts. And when I met with him, what he said is, he's like, you know, the therapy was designed for repairing damage from severe drug abuse, but doesn't really matter how you got the damage, the process of healing it will be relatively similar. And so in my case, it was basically not sleeping for 3 years and stressing out too much.
Yeah.
But I went down, I did this 3-day IV treatment, and my world completely flipped upside down. And when I went in, I was feeling depressed and unmotivated. My brain wasn't working well. And by the time that I was done with the 3 days, all of the depression had gone away. My sense of like happiness and motivation had come up dramatically. My brain function had not only come back to where it was, but it became meaningfully better than I had ever experienced before.
Wow.
And one of the other things that happened there that was the most profound for me was that my sense of empathy increased dramatically. Mm. And like everything that I had studied throughout my life from spiritual traditions about how we're all interconnected, all of a sudden became palpable, and I could start to actually see and feel the interconnectedness of life in a way that I never could before. And I had this sort of aha moment, which was, if we could figure out how to take this type of experience and produce it at scale, where through a relatively simple chemical intervention, someone could dramatically improve their happiness, their sense of motivation, capacity, their intelligence, but also their empathy and compassion, so that their intrinsic desire was to not only benefit themselves, but to benefit their communities and the world around them. That if we could figure out how to do that, that would not only improve the life of the individual people we were touching, but actually could allow for a massive amount more intelligence and resource be put into solving all the problems of the world.
Yeah.
And so
no big deal. Aha moment.
Yeah. That was essentially how this started. I tried at the time to partner with that doctor and take his IV therapy and open clinics all over the world. But unfortunately, a few weeks into that process, he ended up becoming quite ill and he passed away, and most of his research was with him. So the idea still stood, but the path to get there didn't. And it took many years after that of trying to meet with different scientists and formulators and seeing if anyone could figure out how to deliver on this concept, because I didn't have the scientific capacity to, I just had the vision.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until my brother actually decided to partner with me in 2014 where the science started to become a reality. His background has been in complex system science for most of his life, using complex systems modeling for understanding and solving large-scale global issues. And it was clear that the model of science, if applied to medicine, could fundamentally change how healthcare worked and what we were capable of achieving, but no one had ever done that before. And all the other scientists that I had met with loved the idea, but also mostly said it wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until we started to have that model of science that things started to become a reality. And then from there, we started getting to attract more and more researchers with, you know, incredible degrees of talent, and start to develop a new sort of approach to research and development that allows for making, you know, both products and information that can actually substantially change the quality of life for people, their capacity, and at least to some decent extent, hopefully support the parts of the brain and nervous system that are responsible for things like empathy, mm-hmm. and work to sort of change the value system that people have through increasing the focus on the well-being of everyone as opposed to just the well-being of ourselves.
You know, I've seen the work that you're describing, you know, really relevant in my own life. You know, I've had 6 different concussions, sponsored snowboarder for a while, and I noticed when my baseline, you know, from a physical but also a neurological chemical perspective isn't high, my capacity to care is just, it's not as accessible to me or even feel, you know, for others. And it's been an ongoing journey, and I find many of us as entrepreneurs, even like you were describing, you burn yourself out, or, you know, you're under-resourced, and depression, I find, you know, whether you call it that, is the underbelly. But I think that it's not always in the doing, say meditating or working out or those things. They're valuable, but those don't always move the needle. And so I know you've done some amazing impact, you know, since you began this 5 years ago. And so just curious, for those that are maybe hearing about this for the first time, if you can quantify the scope of impact that you've had over the last 5 years and, you know, some of the results and what is possible for someone that's like, wow, I've been in my stuff and there is another way, kind of like your IV experience, so that they can kind of become more familiar with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'd be happy to talk to the scope. And first, I actually want to speak to something else you said there, just regarding some of your own experiences with seeing, you know, where your capacity increases or decreases depending on what state you're in. And, you know, obviously with things like concussions, it's going to change substantially. But one of the things, so, you know, my focus on well-being and on quality of life started predominantly through the lens of personal growth and psychology. And that was where the majority of my work was for probably the first 10 years of my career. And so for the longest time, anytime there was something that wasn't working, I was thinking of it through the lens of psychology and what belief systems need to be understood and healed in order for this to shift, or, you know, things along these lines. And I still think that psychology is deeply, deeply important. But what my work over the years has come to teach me is the importance of balancing sort of psychological work and physiological support, where, you know, I've come to think of this sort of like hardware and software. So mm-hmm. body, or specifically brain and nervous system, are kind of like the hardware of a computer. And then your psychology is essentially the software. And those two have to work in tandem. You know, if you take a computer from 1995 and you try to install a new operating system on it, it's just going to crash because the hardware can't actually manage that level of psychology, right? Or that level of data. And, you know, vice versa, if you've got phenomenally working hardware but terrible software, you're just not going to get that much out of it. And so I think a lot of what's really important in terms of people kind of designing the life that they want, is figuring out how to get these things in balance, where you absolutely need to work on the psychology and anything that's holding you back or any limiting belief systems. And if your chemistry is off, or if your sleep is off, or your diet is off, like, these things are going to make it profoundly harder to be able to actually make the necessary changes in psychology. And that was something I got to see a lot when I was running Body Mind, was I'd see people going through these deep therapeutic processes, and some of them would change really rapidly, and some would work every bit as hard, but not make very much progress. And oftentimes, once we could figure out how to dial in whatever was off in physiology, things would start to change psychologically at a much faster pace. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's this sort of balance to try to strike of getting, you know, getting the body, getting the mind to work well physically, and then simultaneously doing the personal growth work and skill development and the everything else on top of it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where people really get the primary benefit. And then at Neurohacker, we've tried to do both of those simultaneously. So, you know, the bulk of our work has been in terms of chemistry. So doing advanced research and development to create products that can change capacity in different areas, right? The majority of our work to date has been in cognition, in longevity. But in addition to trying to make those biochemical changes, we also do a lot to try to educate people and support increasingly more evolved worldviews and views of oneself, right? So we have our podcast called Collective Insights, where we have different experts on, not only in the field of medicine, but also in the field of psychology and existential risk and civilization design, and really starting to do deep thought exploration in multiple different fields so as to upgrade our understanding of the world and our understanding of how we interface with it, while upgrading our chemistry so we have more capacity to show up to those conversations in a bigger way. And then, yeah, in terms of scope, I think we've been able to help, you know, 100,000 or so people at a product level over the last year or two. And in terms of a lot of the messaging, I don't know. I mean, we've had numerous pieces that have gone out and gotten, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of views. it's hard to keep track of it.
Totally. Like, how do you quantify?
Yeah. But no, I mean, we are fortunate that, you know, every month there's thousands of people that are using the products and listening to the podcasts and writing in, talking about how their lives are changing. And some of those are pretty profound stories. And I think those stories are kind of what always keep me excited and going, even when, you know, running multiple startups at the same time isn't necessarily easy.
Yep. Totally. So I love all of that. And I love, you know, your perspective too on, you know, hardware and software. And I find too, you know, I often hear I'm doing all the right things, but, you know, I feel like I'm not moving the needle forward. And I think it is really looking at it from this holistic frame. You know, it isn't just personal development or consume, audiobook, you know, seminar, et cetera, but also, you know, looking at the brain chemistry. I found that true in my own life many times, and also the practices as well. And so I feel like you and I could go for a while, but in the sake of time, let's move into the rapid fire round, which is going to be a series of lightning questions coming at you. And just after that, everyone, James is going to share about the giveaway that he's got, which will tie in this conversation really nicely to take it a step forward. So are you ready for this rapid fire lightning round coming at you?
Let's do it.
All right. Question number one, fill in the blank. If you really knew me, you would know what?
That I'm basically an oversized child and I just like to play all the time.
Love that. Next question. What is one practice that you do regularly that you feel sets you up for success?
I think the one that I've gotten the most benefit out of is a gratitude practice. Spending a couple minutes first thing upon waking and also right before going to bed, just reflecting on what I'm most grateful for. And it's short, but it's had more benefit than almost any other practice I've ever tried.
Yeah, so good. Next question. What is one weird and surprising fact that most people don't know about you?
It's funny because I don't, since they're part of my life, I don't know that I consider them weird. But in terms of thinking of other people's responses, I would probably say the fact that I've been very openly in polyamorous relationships for most of the last decade is considered to be somewhat out of the norm and not something everyone knows about me.
Yeah. Next question. What is one book that you've been reading recently that you really are enjoying or you feel like would be cool to share with some of the listeners?
So I've actually started up an old series that I read when I was a kid, which is the series from Carlos Castaneda, Journey to Ixtlan and all of those. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to reread those the last couple of weeks and then really enjoying kind of going back into that journey.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cool. And last question for you is, what does living the unconventional life mean to you?
I think it means living a life that isn't guided by what other people think you should do or what other people want, but guided by that which actually lights you up the most and causes you to want to jump out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, so good. James Schmachtenberger, everyone. James, tell us about the giveaway that you've got for one of our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're going to do a giveaway of two Neurohacker products. One is called Qualia Mind, and this is our sort of premium cognitive support. It's designed to help increase brain function across essentially all of the major types of cognitive function, creativity and discernment and processing speed, etc. So we're going to be giving away a bottle of that, as well as a bottle of our newest product, which is called Eternus. And this is a product that is designed to increase cellular energy and energy output of cells, which, you know, translates to extending life expectancy and, more importantly, improving the quality of health and life during the years that we're on the planet. And so we're going to be going ahead and giving away both of those to one of your listeners.
Yeah, super, super generous. And I know retails for, yeah, $300 plus for those products. And for those tuning in, you can head over to unconventionallifeshow.com, click on the giveaway tab. We'll have all the details on that. And we always love getting your emails. If you feel like you really want this giveaway, feel free to write us in and tell us why. And, you know, James, for those that want to learn more about, you know, the Neurohacker Collective, more about, you know, some of the products, you know, you offer a variety of different, you know, products, podcast content as well. What's the best place for them to go and the best way for them to stay in touch?
Yeah. So the best thing is going to be to go to neurohacker.com. We have, you know, information on the products there, as well as just very like deep information and research into what we're doing and if that area is of interest. And then also through that site, you can access the Collective Insights podcast, which is something we've been doing for a little over a year now and has been very, very well received. And it's the sort of combination of deep thought exploration into both health and civilization design. But those are probably the major areas in which to connect and follow up.